If you are going to the plaza for the big lighting ceremony this Thursday night, you will get the answer to the age-old question of how many Saturday Night Live cast members it takes to light up a shopping center. No, just me. I'm the only one here who's wondered that. Okay. Well, Kansas City native Heidi Gardner is home to do the honors of flipping the switch, and we're going to talk to her today. I'm Gina Kaufman, and before we talk with Heidi about SNL and where it's headed, among other things, I want to introduce one of her alter egos, Bailey Gismert, a teenage movie critic who sometimes appears on Weekend Update. In this clip, Michael Che is interviewing Bailey about the top movies this fall.
Okay, Bailey, how was your summer? Let's start there.
Well, I mean, I got thrown into the pool by every one of my guy friends. I mean, I guess it's because I'm, like, light? I don't know.
Bailey squirms uncomfortably and rolls her eyes and tries not to smile. It's very cringy, but in kind of an endearing way.
All right, Bailey, so what movies have you seen recently?
Oh, okay. Well, I saw It, Chapter 2, and I don't know. It was, like, awkward.
That's also how she reviews the next movie.
So I saw Judy, and it's, like, awkward.
But when the anchor asks her about the Joker, everything changes. She kind of looks away and starts playing with her hair.
So, I mean, like, I guess I saw it, and, like, yeah, it was, like, psycho, but, like, it's nothing I can't handle.
What? Bailey, do you like the Joker?
Okay, his name is Arthur. And I don't like him. I just, like, think I could help him. I'm like, yeah, like, Arthur and I, like, have a lot in common. Like, we're silly, we're fit, we have good lips.
Heidi Gardner, welcome home.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about that character, Bailey Gismert.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think she's me. I think she's my nieces. I think she's a lot of people's daughters. It's just changing and going through a lot. And yeah, just showing it on live TV.
She is a teenager, and a lot of your characters are really young. And excuse the term, but just like the teensiest bit ditzy, and not just Bailey Gismert, but also the girl in the Instagram couple, the character who writes captions for Barbie on social media. Is that like kind of a sweet spot for you comedically?
I do think it is fun to, I think I have an anxious mind. So anytime I can play someone who's a little brain dead, it's like, that would be nice to have a little air let out of the brain. So yeah, it is fun to play a little bit of a dead in the eyes character. Yeah.
You are actually in your 30s, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I read that you feel like you showed up late to the party when it comes to acting and comedy.
A little bit, I guess, in the way that you feel like you're supposed to have figured out what you want to do by like age 10 or something.
Right. Taking the MCATs.
Yes. And I definitely always was so into comedy, so into SNL, so into movies, but just didn't know a path for that. So I feel late to the game that I wasn't like immediately out of the womb like acting.
I read a profile of you in a local magazine, 435 magazine, and it was super interesting. A childhood friend of yours who is a lawyer now said that she was not at all surprised by this turn of events of you becoming famous for comedy. She was remembering what it was like watching you do prank calls in the days before caller ID. You'd call people up, she said, having no idea what you were going to say, and all of your friends would be cracking up as you just spontaneously became some random character and then stayed in character for the whole call. Do you remember what was going on in your head when you did that?
I don't remember quite. I mean, it was like just blissfully unaware. Like, that's obviously improv and characters, but at the time it was just like, this is a prank phone call. I'm going to commit. I think I'm good at it because a lot of my other friends were like, I can't do it. I'm going to laugh, you know? So they'd always be like, you do it. And
so you could do it without laughing.
Typically. I mean, once they started going, it would be a little harder. But also, I think, like, that was also driving me, knowing, like, they were laughing. I was good at it. I was like, I'm going to keep in this prank and go as hard as possible.
Do you remember any of them?
I do remember, like, calling, like, just bait shops and, like, asking and, like, for hamsters instead of bait. I mean, it was pretty juvenile, but very committed. And, yeah, we would find businesses, like sewing machine companies, and I'd be getting in a fight with another one of my friends on the other line. And, like, we would stage them pretty professionally, I would say.
Do you remember the first time you realized you were funny or at least had this ability to make people laugh?
I mean, I do remember the first time I made my older brother laugh. And I think I was like, oh, that was a big moment. Because I knew he had good taste. And that was probably when I was like 6 or 7. And I don't think I thought that was going to take me anywhere, but I was like, okay, if Justin laughed, this is big.
Do you remember what made him laugh?
Yeah, we were watching MTV Spring Break, and Joey Lawrence was appeared, and they were like, oh, Joey, like, we wish you would perform, you know? And he was like, I can't do it. Like, he just kept on asking, like, acting like he was really put upon. And then suddenly he was like, let's kick it. And then all his dancers came out. And I think I just made a commentary statement like, oh, you can't perform, yet all your dancers are there. But I was like 7. And I think my brother was like, hey, that's quick wit or something.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then your path, though, was like, grew up in Kansas City, went to KU for a couple of years, and then had a pretty long stint in LA as a hairstylist.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I think, kind of went through college, wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Thought, oh, like, I'm good at doing hair. I'd cut a few of my friends' hair. So moved out to LA to pursue that and was working in a salon and had a clientele and was happy enough, I think. Like, it's a fun job and you're talking to lots of people every day. And I worked with, like, some amazing women. But yeah, I went to go see a show at the Groundlings Theater, and I was just like, that is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. And at the time, Melissa McCarthy was still a groundling, and I remember my husband and I being like, why isn't this woman the biggest star in the world? And then 6 months later, Bridesmaids came out, and, you know, at that time, Keegan-Michael Key was performing there, and Jordan Peele, like, so, and Mikey Day, who I'm on the show with now. And after that, I was encouraged by my friend, my husband, and my brother, the same one I made laugh, to take an improv class there, and then just kept going.
So your earliest days on SNL, I want to play a clip from those days. This is one of the first characters, if not the first character you became known for. Every girlfriend of every boxer in every boxing movie ever. What's the official name of that character?
Every boxer's girlfriend from every movie about boxing ever.
Okay. Well, here she is on what's supposed to be the good news segment on Weekend Update to give people a break from all the bad news out there. This is from 2017.
Okay. Holiday spending is expected to be up this year.
Oh, come on.
Oh, did I say something?
You know, I've been here before with you holiday spending a lot. Okay? You're up, and we're happy, and things are good, and then boom, you're down, okay? And I can't watch that. Okay.
Let's move on to some good news.
Okay, yeah.
Apple predicts this release of the new iPhone X will be their biggest of all time.
Okay. Right. You know what? When's it gonna stop? You know, every year, a new iPhone. And you know what? They tell me it's different this time, but you know what? I don't give up on my old phone after a year. You think you're the fighter? I'm the fighter. I still got my 4S.
And then when they tell her she should probably get a new phone, she asks what kind of woman she would be if she did that. Heidi Gardner, tell me about this character.
This character came just from growing up seeing a lot of boxing movies. Rocky, The Fighter. I had seen a preview for the movie Southpaw probably in 2016. And when Rachel McAdams spoke, I was like, I think that's the exact same thing Amy Adams said in The Fighter. Like, and then I was like, oh my God, these characters all say the same thing. So I had just written it as like a 15-second little piece for like a comedy show I was doing in LA. And then I got into this Just for Laughs festival and did like another just 20 seconds. And then once I got on SNL, I was like, oh, you know what? Like on Weekend Update, when you see the chyron of whoever the guest is, I was like, every boxer's girlfriend from every movie about boxing ever would look good in font. So I'm going to do that on Weekend Update, or I'm going to try to.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about that trying to process. I read Ellie Kemper's memoir, and she tells this whole story of getting an audition for SNL, coming up with characters for the audition, the details of the process. And I mean, this is obvious that I, as a person who works in news, have never imagined this process in great detail, but it's pretty fascinating what that's like. Can you tell your SNL audition story?
Sure. I was fortunate enough to kind of get a pre-audition in LA where I knew some of the producers and talent department were going to be, and they came and saw me at the Groundlings, which at that point was like kind of my comedy home. So I was on like my home, your home stadium. And I did like a 5-minute audition and that's or showcase. And then a week later, I found out they wanted to test me in New York. And I really wanted the job bad. So I was like, you get about 5 minutes. And I was like, I want to make it undeniable. So I did 12 characters total. And I just like packed it in. I just wanted to show like as much range as possible.
How fast were you talking doing 12 characters in 5 minutes?
Oh my God. I mean, I think I probably went over. They say everybody does. So I'm going to guess it was like 6.5 minutes. But, you know, you're going fast. Like I had it memorized. I had it down. But I knew I had to like take my time, get into each character too. So it's like this really delicate balance. Plus, you need to look like you're having fun so they're comfortable watching you. But also the first audition, I'd never been to SNL, so I was so memorized, I knew what I was going to do, but what I didn't plan for was the first time I walked out into the studio and saw the stage was the first time I'd ever seen it. So I didn't prepare myself just as a fan being like, oh my God, it's like SNL, oh my. And then suddenly they're like 5, 4, 3, and then I'm auditioning, and then, so I blacked out. I did the audition. They called me to come back a week later and said, we want to see her again. But, you know, they want to know you can do new material in a week. So they're like, we want to see a new 5 minutes. So I
took... And then you'd already blown through 12 characters.
Yes. So I had to use, like, my bench characters, like, which was scary, but also they were characters I loved that maybe didn't, like, fully work in a sketch, but there was, like, a tidbit of, like, still some resonance and stuff that I thought was funny in my point of view. So
can
I did
you give an example?
Like I did, what did I do? You know, I did like a version of my mom who's always like super positive. I mean, even like if I washed my hands correctly, she'd be like, honey, the way you wash your hands, it's beautiful. Like, so I just did a version of like a really praising mom. I don't think she's ever praised me for washing my hands, but I mean, it's probably come close.
Maybe when you were 3.
Yeah, probably. So yeah, I did that second audition. And that time I reminded myself, like, try to soak this all in, because if you don't ever come back here, like, you're going to just want to remember you were on that stage, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What has been the biggest surprise to you getting to know SNL from the inside after being a huge fan?
I think what a machine it is, and that every department is working so hard to pull off something that should be impossible every week. I mean, the amount of sets, the amount of costumes, the wigs. It's just like people working at their hardest and at all hours all week long. And I just can't fathom that amount of dedication, but I see it every single week and it's pretty amazing to witness.
I'm Gina Kaufman chatting with Heidi Gardner. When we return, we'll hear about Saturday Night Live in the age of Me Too and Donald Trump and Russian hacking and impeachment hearings and all the crazy politics of our time. If you want to join that conversation, you can at 816-235-2888 or tweet us your question. We're at KCURCST. Back in a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to the homegrown Heidi Gardner about her rise to prominence on Saturday Night Live. I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about the relevance of the show right now, because I think for a lot of us, as the news gets weirder and weirder, we find ourselves reacting to every crazy turn of events by wondering what they will do with this on SNL. Is that a lot of pressure?
It is a lot of pressure. Yeah, because you know right now that people really need to laugh because the current political climate is so crazy. And I do realize that by people coming up to me a lot and being like, thank, even if it was a sketch that I wasn't in, they're like, thank you so much for this week's cold open. Thank you for going there. Thank you. And I'm like, I wasn't in it. I didn't write it. Like, I don't want to like take credit, you know, but they're like, no, like just the show and as a whole. And I make sure to even go to like some of my other cast members sometimes and be like, this person on the street really liked that. And you like really made them smile and it seems like they really needed it. So
your characters seem largely not political, even though you do appear in political sketches, but you generally seem to represent the public almost. You're like the person talking about politics at dinner or fainting during impeachment hearings rather than playing a politician.
Right. I'm not a senator, but I'm a senator's wife or like something like that.
Totally.
Yes. Yeah. And I think I just tap into that by life experience and not necessarily being in the political realm is not like my go-to.
Yeah, you play a type rather than a specific known person.
Yes, typically.
Walking this line, though, between humor and outrage has to be a real tightrope walk at times. Do you guys have conversations about the overall tone you want to take from one week to the next?
Yeah, I do think there has to be occasionally a sensitivity, a delicateness, even for some of the cast members that are playing a particular character. You know, I've seen someone get assigned a role of playing someone that's like, hey, I am playing this person because they're in the news right now, but like, I don't necessarily want a funny wig or funny eyebrows. Like, we're not going at this person, you know, like it's just they happen to be in this trial right now. Or, but then at the same time, there are things where SNL, I think, they don't necessarily shy away from. It's like, go towards the fear. Like, people want to know, like, it's in the news. Like, what are you going to do with it? So
I want to play a clip from, I hesitate to say back in the Me Too era because it's not over, but the height of the Me Too conversation in the news. I'll put it that way. There was a girl group made up of the female cast members, and they sang a bubbly pop song called Welcome to Hell about the maddening level of overthinking that men were suddenly having to do every little move they made. It wasn't by any means new, though, to women. So the women singing the song were showing men around the paranoid hell they'd always lived in. I'm going to play a little of the song, and then we'll talk about your role in that sketch, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here it is. Welcome to Hell from Saturday Night Live. This was at the end of 2017.
Now House of Cards is ruined, and that really sucks. Well, here's a list of stuff that's ruined for us.
Parking and walking and Uber and ponytails, bathrobes and nighttime and drinking and hotels and beds.
Nothing good happens in a bed.
Welcome to hell.
Welcome to hell.
This isn't news.
No, 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 not new.
Our situation's been a doo since we got booze.
I got two booze.
So this is amazing.
Yeah.
Your role in the sketch was super goofy. You were dressed up like a cartoon perpetrator, kinda,
yes.
And like in a trench coat, an insane mustache, very obviously up to no good.
Yes. It's so funny. I'm like remembering back to that, yeah. A flasher type, I think I was.
Yeah, like as imagined in the late 80s.
Yes.
Sexual assault is such a serious issue, and the women singing in the song are making really legit points. And here you come in a trench coat, and we know perpetrators aren't that obvious, but the absurdity of your character provided this very valuable relief from the not funny aspect of it, which is all of it, I guess. But still, it's a delicate dance, like we were talking about.
Yeah, it's so interesting that it's a delicate dance, and at the same time, and these like master comedians are singing the song, but it's like also like, you know, one of those like epiphanies, like, yes, like this is hell sometimes, like being in the mind of a woman and all the like self-protection we have to do. And
yeah, like, how am I going to hold my keys? And
yes, like just even saying, yeah, parking's ruined. Like, so it's this weird thing where it's like you've been living in this hell and then someone finally like comments on it. And like, it's like this big breath of fresh air where it's almost like, I don't know if I want to laugh or cry, but you're right. Like, this is hard.
What was it like to play the character you played in that?
I mean, I think it just felt so, aside from the seriousness of it, I mean, it just felt so goofy to look like this Pink Panther type dude on set in this like candy wonderland of a set. So I guess being in that costume, I probably didn't have the wherewithal to think like of the seriousness, the tone of the character I was playing. And but also, yeah, I don't know. I was in a Pink Panther outfit.
There have been different eras of women on SNL, the Molly Shannon era, the Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph era. There was the Melissa McCarthy era, just full stop Melissa McCarthy. And then I feel like we're entering a new era with you and Kate McKinnon and Cecily Strong. What do you feel? Do you feel like a team or like a...
Yeah, it's really cool. Number one, aside from the fact of just being like fans of these women, I mean, Cecily, I'm so so into characters and grounded and committed characters that you see in real life. And Cecily to me is just like a beacon of like can do any voice, any mannerism. She can sing, she can and to get to see that every week, the same with Kate and Adie, and then us more like up and comers with like Melissa and Ego and Chloe, to get to see that every week, to learn from it and also bring our point of views to the show, which are all very different, is really cool to see. And at the same time, I know it's cheesy, but there is like a sisterhood with all of us. We're very open and honest with our feelings and emotions. And they're a very safe space for me to go every week and be like, this is awesome. Oh, I'm sad about this. But like building that trust on the emotional level also builds that trust chemistry wise, and then you start being like, ooh, let's write this together. That like just the more that you talk, hang out, become friends. So I feel really supported in that way.
Speaking of the different perspectives you all bring, do you think that your Kansas City roots inform the perspective you bring to the room when you're working on these sketches?
I do. You know, I have to say that I do think I'm a hard worker and am happy to work as hard and as long as it takes to get something right. And I think by growing up in Kansas City with a mom who always had, you know, two or three jobs, you know, parents that were, nothing was necessarily comfortable. I saw people work hard, just to, you know, be able to go to the movies on a Friday night. So I think it gave me a really good work ethic. And even when I'm around the studio, sometimes people are like, you're from the Midwest, right? And I'm like, yeah, how'd you know? And they're like, you can just tell. There's nothing entitled about you, or, you know, so that's pretty cool.
What do you like to do when you come home? The places you have to go or things you have to experience to make a trip complete?
Okay, well, I mean, I've said it a million times, but the chips and salsa at Jalapenos in Brookside is the best I've ever had in my life, and I can't find anything even close. I've been searching for over 15 years now. So always have to get that. A barbecue does not compare anywhere else. So that's an obvious one. I love just driving down Ward Parkway, like rolling down the windows and listening to music. And of course, the Plaza.
And so. you can add turn on the Plaza lights is one thing I just always have to do. You can add that. Heidi Gardner, thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Heidi Gardner will do the ceremonial flipping of the switch at the Plaza Lighting Ceremony Thanksgiving night. I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service takes a hard look at the rural hospitals that are closing. What do you even do without a hospital? That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've got the podcast My Fellow Kansans from the Kansas News Service. We've been playing it every Tuesday for a little while now, so that's how we'll conclude today's show as well. In the last episode, we heard about whether a community can thrive even as its population shrinks. Well, today's episode digs into one problem towns run up against with that whole idea: how to sustain a hospital.
Rural America is losing its hospitals. More than 100 hospitals in rural communities have closed since 2010.
Two of those were in the southeast Kansas communities of Independence and Fort Scott.
I don't understand how they can just so blatantly close the hospital. I mean, where is the humanity? You know, what are people like us supposed to do?
But I drive by that facility every day, and I just get mad driving by it, thinking, my God, what a waste. Because that was such a great, great thing. 170 employees, all good-paying jobs.
1946, I was born there, and both of my kids were born there. And it's a sad situation.
Few things mark the decline of a rural community like the closing of a hospital. It's stark evidence that a place has become something less than it once was and probably will be even less in the years ahead.
And it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Our rural communities are challenged, and because of that, our small hospitals are challenged as well.
But what if people living in the state's remote, emptying areas embraced a different kind of hospital? Scaled down, adjusted to a new reality, and sized to what rural towns can actually afford. I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service. Many things are crucial to the survival of rural communities: quality schools, decent housing, high-speed internet, and good roads. But in this episode, we'll focus on what many who live in those communities put at the top of that list: healthcare. We'll diagnose the problems, financial and otherwise, threatening rural hospitals. We'll explore whether changes in the way healthcare is delivered can save those life and death services. Not every rural Kansas hospital is in dire straits. I found some bright spots during my travels across the state. Expanding safety net clinics are providing more primary care, particularly in southeast Kansas. And visionary hospital CEOs and individuals willing to open their checkbooks are helping some communities buck the trends. But for the most part, they are exceptions to the rule. The numbers, says Brock Slaybaugh of the National Rural Health Association, tell a bleak story.
46% of all rural hospitals nationwide have a negative operating margin.
In Kansas, Slaybaugh said in a presentation to state lawmakers earlier this year, the situation is even more alarming.
81 to 100% of our state's hospitals are operating at a negative margin.
Put more bluntly, they're losing money. Shrinking populations mean fewer patients. And those who remain are typically older, sicker, and poorer, making them more expensive to treat. State and federal policies are also to blame, specifically cuts in federal Medicare payments and the state's decision to forego Medicaid expansion. Research offers a mixed picture on whether losing your hospital poses a threat to your actual health. Some studies say when people are forced to travel longer distances, they often fail to get preventive care, the sort of early treatment that can stop health problems from becoming life-threatening. Lack of ready access to emergency and obstetric services can also put people at risk. Still, research has yet to show that, broadly speaking, a community's health declines when the local hospital shuts down. Economic impact, well, that's a different story. Hospitals mean jobs. They keep healthcare dollars in the community. So when towns lose their only hospital, they get poorer. Per capita income declines and unemployment rates rise, and they become much less attractive to employers. Until recently, dueling hospitals in the neighboring but rival communities of Anthony and Harper in south central Kansas were among those on the endangered list. The communities were facing the real possibility of two hospitals becoming zero if the late Neil Patterson hadn't intervened.
Neil was proud of where he came from. No matter how far he traveled, he loves coming home to the family farm on the Kansas-Oklahoma border.
A native of Harper County, Patterson went on to co-found the Cerner Corporation, a Kansas City-based medical records giant.
A crisis wasn't happening yet, but he could see the writing on the wall.
That's Patterson's daughter, Lindsay Patterson-Smith. She joined people from both towns on a scorching July day to dedicate a new hospital, one that couldn't have been built without her father, who, before he died of cancer in 2017, promised to cover much of the hospital's $41 million cost, but only if the communities agreed to set aside their differences and share the Patterson Health Center.
Generally, he did not like to have his name on buildings, but I think he would have approved of this one. On behalf of the Patterson family and the Patterson Family Foundation, we are honored and excited to be along for the ride. Thank you.
Both of the old competing hospitals in Anthony and Harper were 25-bed facilities, downsized in the 1990s to survive an earlier tide of rural hospital closures. To help these smaller facilities, known as critical access hospitals, survive, Congress told Medicare to pay them slightly more than other types of hospitals. The same politicians who promised those higher payments knew the formula could also be an incentive for more hospitals than rural economies could support. So they put in rules that said critical access hospitals needed to be at least 35 miles from the next closest hospital. But those rules allowed for exceptions, and several Kansas communities took advantage of that loophole, including, you guessed it, Anthony and Harper. Located only 10 miles apart, each ended up with its very own critical access hospital. And both did okay for a while. But by 2014, after years of financial problems, both hospitals were in serious trouble. Even so, people in the communities continued to resist the idea of a merger. So the Kansas News Service sent health reporter Brian Thompson down to investigate.
The rivalry between Anthony and Harper dates back a long way. Harper Hospital's chief financial officer, Sandra Owen, has lived in the county for 20 years.
Really, what it boiled down to is back in the 1800s, Anthony stole the courthouse from Harper.
There was an election in 1879 to decide whether Anthony or Harper, then the county's largest town, would be the county seat. Anthony won the courthouse, but the rivalry lingers, and it's complicating efforts to solve a big problem facing both towns, the potential loss of their hospitals. Martha Hadsell, who chairs the Anthony Medical Center Board, says they can't continue to rely on local tax revenues to fill the gap. That could mean a partnership between the two facilities, or perhaps even one new hospital to serve the entire county. But Hadsell says a consensus on what to do is still miles away.
We know we've got to build community buy-in. We have to develop a clear, combined vision. And we don't have that yet.
An analysis by a private consulting group says the best option is to build a new combined hospital that won't be an easy sell. At Connie's Beauty Shop in Harper, Bonnie June Day is sitting under a hairdryer.
Leave Harper alone. Our hospital is doing fine without being consolidated with them. We've got good doctors here. We pay taxes on our hospital here. We just got through redoing our hospital, and it's great the way it is.
Day says she thinks taxpayers in Harper are willing to pay more if that's what it takes to keep their hospital open. Meanwhile, at Irwin Potter Pharmacy in Anthony, eight women who call themselves the Ladies of the Round Table are sitting next to the soda fountain. They're having a lively discussion. They hope the two hospitals can work together to avoid duplication of services. But they want both hospitals to remain open, and they want federal policymakers to help small towns keep their hospitals.
Even though that all these little hospitals are spread all over here and there, the federal government needs to realize that we're in a rural area. We're not in Kansas City or someplace like that. Let one of them come out here and have a heart attack and see how well he likes it.
Yeah.
The ladies want an emergency room in town, not 5 or 10 miles away. Keeping both hospitals open but consolidating administration is among the options. A merger would require the patrons of one of the hospital districts to voluntarily dissolve their district. Given the history these two communities share, that's asking a lot, no matter what's at stake.
But Martha Hadsell, the head of the Anthony Hospital Board, stuck with it. And she was perhaps the ideal person to press the case, because she had built up trust in both communities, living in Anthony but teaching for decades in Harper.
Step one was getting the boards together, because I would describe one of our first joint board meetings as a junior high dance. We each sat on opposite sides of the room and stared at each other.
Arms folded.
Yes. So, well, we began assigning seats. Assigning seats meant you had to sit by someone different. We tried some cooperative learning activities where maybe they would never speak up in that public meeting, but if I asked them to talk to their shoulder partner about a certain thing, mm-hmm. write down their key thoughts, and then share it, they would.
So the two boards actually were reflections of their communities.
And you have to realize there had been a couple of other merger attempts that had failed.
Okay.
Within the past 10 years, 20 years. And so, yes, as we started this, it was clear, well, this is one more attempt that's going to fail.
So there was a trust issue.
Well, yes.
Eventually, the boards agreed to dissolve the Harper Hospital District, merge with Anthony, and take Neil Patterson up on his offer to stake them to a new state-of-the-art hospital. But they couldn't move forward until they had convinced citizens that a merger would result in something better than they were losing. So, to underscore the benefits of cooperation, they held a meeting at the town's shared high school and made their case.
And we show the data, show the charts, show the graphs. Here's what income versus expenses looks like. Here's what your property tax numbers look like to fill that gap. You come in with the information, and you take people through the steps and the decision-making, and by the time you're finished, most of them are shaking their head yes to what the boards had chosen to do.
It was progress, but they needed voters to make it official. And because the Harper Hospital District was the one being dissolved, only its patrons could sign the petition. So, Hadsell says, groups of hand-picked volunteers hit the streets of Harper and started knocking on doors.
Well, there were some times that you went to the door and you spent a half hour on the porch and you left without a signature. Sometimes you went to the door and they said, well, it's about time, and they grabbed the petition and signed it. Yeah. And there were some times that you went to the door, you spent that half hour, and they changed their mind and signed the petition. Mm-hmm.
So you needed to gather 51% of the registered voters in Harper on a petition to approve the merger.
That's correct.
And you did that.
We did that. We got about 60% when we finally said, I think that's good enough.
Things moved pretty quickly after that. They bought land next to the high school and began work on what planners hoped would be a new kind of rural hospital, one that could serve as a model for other communities. The final product is pretty much everything they could have hoped for: a gorgeous building, modern equipment, public spaces that serve as virtual art galleries, and a cafeteria that rivals any restaurant in the area. But all of that prompts the question, is the hospital something that other communities could realistically hope to replicate? Well, for starters, not without a big chunk of startup money from a millionaire, not without some trust established when the high school consolidated, and maybe not without somebody like Hadsell, who used skills honed wrangling third graders to get rival towns to team up. Still, Lindsay Patterson-Smith, Neil's daughter and the head of the Patterson Family Foundation, believes the new hospital can be a proving ground for ideas to improve rural health care.
We've learned a lot already through the process that we've been in, you know, from the two districts down to one, and the building a new hospital, and what does that look like? How do you keep the integrity of the home communities while bringing them into the future? You know, that's a fine balance.
So you really do imagine that you're creating a rural health laboratory here.
Absolutely, yeah. Living lab. Yeah, we we want to take some lessons from it and then go figure out what is going to work in another community, mm-hmm. go try it in another community. And you know, if it's as simple as inspiration, that's something. If it's a white paper of this is the best practices of how you bring two communities together, that's something. And then, yeah, at the end of the day, if you can write the book and say this is how we're going to do rural healthcare, that's a win.
Anthony resident Shirley Rischel hopes it's a win. At first, she wasn't in favor of the merger.
I was skeptical. Mm-hmm. I really was.
Why?
You know, you always have doubts when something new comes up.
But like others, Rischel says seeing the numbers that documented the hospital's struggles and revealed how much taxpayers were spending to subsidize them brought her around.
I'm hoping it will work. Mm-hmm. I'm really hoping. Because neither one could survive on their own.
Few Kansas communities have a Neil Patterson to come to their rescue, says Tom Bell, the head of the Kansas Hospital Association. But he says there are lessons to be learned from the process used to bring the rival communities together.
Folks that might not have talked to each other in the past are realizing that they really do need to look more at collaboration.
For many towns, Bell says, collaborating may be harder than it was for Anthony and Harper. They got a new hospital for their efforts. But others, he says, may have to confront the reality that they no longer have the people or the tax base to support a traditional hospital, a facility staffed around the clock where people can come and stay when they're really sick or need surgery. Something in between that kind of hospital and a clinic would be more realistic. Something, Bell says, that provides emergency and outpatient care that can quickly get patients who need more to bigger hospitals.
In the past, the whole focus of the discussion may have been how do we maintain that physical building that is the hospital? Mm-hmm. And I think now, at least what we see our members saying is, how do we provide the best access to healthcare in our community that we possibly can? And we want to maintain our hospital in our community. That's incredibly important to our community. All you have to do is go to a small town that whose hospital is challenged, and that's exactly what they'll tell you. But what that hospital looks like in the future may not be exactly what it looks like today. And as I said earlier, there's a number of places around the state that I think would embrace that kind of a discussion now, where 10 or so years ago, they might not have.
So you're talking about creating more options,
right,
for... Right. Rural health providers.
I don't think there's a cookie-cutter approach to this. And what might work in one community is probably different than what might work or be needed in another community. The purpose of all this is to figure out how can we maintain the best access to healthcare in our community as we possibly can. And I think it's important to allow that community to have the flexibility to make that decision.
But it's not that simple, because the federal government has something to say about what you can and can't do, right?
Well, they do, because so many of the people that live in our rural areas are of Medicare age. A lot of our small hospitals have a 50% or more Medicare population that comes to use that hospital. So when you are looking at creating a different model, it has to be something that Medicare is going to recognize.
Well, you can't interrupt that revenue stream or you wouldn't have a hospital.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I think we need kind of a two-pronged strategy to try to get Congress to at least direct the regulatory agencies to do something, but to also try to work with the regulatory agencies and say, look, we've got some people interested in this. Let's do some demonstration projects.
Innovative leadership can also make a difference. Kearney County Hospital CEO Benjamin Anderson recruited doctors to Lakin by promising them time off for mission work. And the Gove County Medical Center in Quinter is using a University of Kansas School of Medicine program as a recruiting tool.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. Polling shows that Gove County's success in recruiting doctors caught the attention of Dante Cheney,
director of the American Communities Project, who touted it on the NPR program 1A.
There's a medical facility there where they have worked very well with the University of Kansas to bring medical students out there. And they come out as couples. And that is a small community of about 1,200 people that now has five primary care physicians in it. It's absolutely fascinating. And then young couples, because they're already married, they get two for one. They get two doctors for the price of one. And they get a family to move out there. And it's really working well for them.
But again, those examples are exceptions. And the testing of new rural healthcare models will take time. Time that many of the state's struggling hospitals may not have. But there is something that policymakers could do to deliver more immediate relief to all the state's health care providers, rural and urban alike, and that is expand Medicaid to cover more low-income Kansans.
If we had expansion in Kansas, it would play a very important role in stabilizing the finances of those rural hospitals.
April Holman heads the Alliance for a Healthy Kansas. It's a coalition funded by several health foundations that's lobbying state lawmakers to approve expansion.
We know from research that has been done looking at states that have expanded Medicaid and states that haven't, like Kansas, that if you're in a state that has expanded Medicaid, you're six times less likely to see rural hospitals close.
Thirty-seven states and the District of Columbia have expanded their Medicaid programs. Despite years of debate and the prospect of getting about $1 billion per year in additional federal funding, Kansas is one of 14 states that haven't. It almost happened in 2017, but lawmakers couldn't override former Republican Governor Sam Brownback's veto. In the most recent session, the Kansas House passed Democratic Governor Laura Kelly's expansion plan, but Republicans in the Senate refused to vote on it, despite mounting pressure from protesters who flooded in to the statehouse. Kansas Senate President Susan Weigel, a Wichita Republican now running for the U.S. Senate, led the opposition.
The governor just called for the Senate to pass a bill that Bernie Sanders, a socialist, endorsed. And that's not going to happen in the Kansas Senate.
The federal government is required to cover no less than 90% of the costs of expansion. Even so, Weigel says expanding coverage to more than 100,000 additional low-income Kansans would be too costly.
If more people enroll in the system than anticipated, as has happened in other states, Kansans will once again face a budget crisis, which will lead to a tax increase to cover the rapidly rising costs of Medicaid.
To quell a revolt by House members, Senate leaders promised to take up the issue when lawmakers return to Topeka this coming January. But there will likely be several competing plans. Meaning, says expansion advocate April Holman, the debate is far from over.
All expansion legislation is not the same. There are a lot of policies out there that could actually provide huge barriers to participation. We want to make sure that we are actually getting health insurance to more low-wage working people in our state so that we can address some of these health care crises that exist.
Our look at the challenges facing rural Kansas continues in the next episode with a visit to Greensburg. We'll check in to see how the small Western Kansas community is faring a dozen years after it was all but wiped off the map by a massive tornado.
I really would like to be more optimistic than what I am. I've told several people I feel like we're kind of walking on crackers.
Greensburg's efforts to bounce back as the state's greenest community, next time on My Fellow Kansans.
That was Jim McLean, host of My Fellow Kansans, signing off on episode 4. This season of the podcast is all about the question of where things are headed for small towns in Kansas. Do we believe the boosters or the naysayers? Tune in for the next installment next Tuesday on Central Standard. That's it for today's show. Our interview with Heidi Gardner, the Kansas City native who's on Saturday Night Live, will be online later today in case you missed it. We'll have it ready for you at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll meet Kansas City's first female fire chief. That's at 10 tomorrow morning, and you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so don't go anywhere.